Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Neither Minnesota nor Anaheim conceded that it was really the Yankees and the A's that should have been in action last night, so the Twins and Angels played Game 3 of the American League Championship Series in Anaheim. The Angels prevailed in a dandy 2-1 pitching duel to take a 2-1 lead in that series. The two teams meet again tonight. The St. Louis Cardinals, down 2-0 to the Giants in the National League Championship Series, will try to win on the road this afternoon to halt the San Francisco Express. Joining me now to ferret out from the four remaining sides, two terrific teams and one winner, is the unfailingly perceptive, if not prescient, ESPN analyst Tim Kirkjian. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
I'm very well, thank you. The story of the playoffs, and really the whole season, I think, is the Minnesota Twins, who, despite their loss to the Angels last night, still have a good chance to advance to the World Series. Should that happen, will Bud Selig and Major League Baseball suffer ridicule and embarrassment over the attempted elimination of the Twins, or are we just too far beyond the labor strife business for that to matter anymore?
Well, it still matters to the Twins fans, that's for sure. And every time Bud shows up at the Metrodome, he's going to hear it. And if someday he has to present that World Championship trophy to the Minnesota Twins, that's going to be quite an embarrassing thing for Bud, given that he basically said that the Twins are an aberration, and he felt no remorse whatsoever for even thinking about contracting them. That has not been received well, nor should it have been.
One of the great stories about the Twins, not only performance on the field, but lots and lots and lots of people showing up to watch them.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, Bill, that is the loudest building that I have ever been in my life. I covered the 87 and the 91 World Series there, and it was like being strapped to speakers at a Springsteen concert. It was just incredibly loud. Again, they are the best story, and the way their fans have, you know, have brought them back, basically, is really a heartwarming thing.
The postseason success of the Angels has been attributed by more than one wag to the fact that Mo Vaughn no longer plays for them. What's the real story of Anaheim's run into and through the playoffs?
Well, I think it starts with the manager, Mike Scioscia, and mainly because they found a bunch of guys who play the way that he used to play, and that is as hard as you can, and as corny as it sounds, they got a bunch of young, scrappy guys who love to play and aren't afraid to play. And I mean, that means, you know, not being afraid to go first to third on a single, you know, not being able to to get hit by a pitch and to do all sorts of things that most teams aren't doing today. The Angels don't play with the pattern of Major League Baseball. They don't walk every at bat. They don't strike out. In fact, they strike out less than any team. They don't hit a whole lot of home runs. They do it a different way. They do it the young, scrappy way. I love the way they play, and that was the way that ended up beating the Yankees, and that will be the way, if they win the World Series, that they beat everybody else.
In the National League, the Giants won twice in St. Louis to take a 2-0 lead. Game 3 is today in San Francisco. Are you surprised at the results of those first two games when you consider second baseman Jeff Kent's motorcycle antics, the hype and weirdness always surrounding Barry Bonds, and until recently, even uncertainty about the future of Dusty Baker in San Francisco?
Yes, it's a very strange situation with the Giants, and you mentioned all of those. The good thing about the Giants is they went rolling into the playoffs. They were about as hot as any team, and the only other team that was as hot was the St. Louis Cardinals. So, yes, I'm surprised the Giants won two there. The Cardinals did not play well in Game 1, and now they are in big trouble. But there's something special about the Giants, and I think as much as we've heard about the Cardinals rallying around their adversity this year, the Giants are doing similar things. They know they might lose their manager. They know, you know, Barry Bonds isn't getting any younger, and they better win at some point when he's on the team. And they've won some games in this postseason, and you just look at them and go, whoa, something special might be going on here. So we have some real interesting teams, and none more interesting to me than the Giants.
St. Louis, of course, suffered losses this season that went well beyond blown saves and untimely errors. Jack Buck and Daryl Kyle both died this year, and St. Louis has made some inspiration of that, but they will, I gather, need more than that to get by the Giants.
Yeah, they really will, because the Giants have just outpitched them so far, and ultimately that's what this comes down to. Plus, the injury to Scott Rolen, who's basically one of their best players, has really hurt them. It's really shortened their bench. And here they are going with 12 pitchers and only four bench guys because Scott Rolen is hurt and really can't play. And that has really hamstrung Tony La Russa into doing some of the things that he likes to do. He loves to use his bench more than anyone, and he just doesn't have his bench there anymore. So they're in a tricky spot, and they've used a lot of energy just to get to this point, and you wonder sometimes if they have enough energy to even get past the Giants.
Tim, maybe it's unfair to characterize the league championship series this way, but it could be said that each series is as notable for the teams that aren't there as for the ones that are. Do you agree?
Well, I totally agree. I mean, you're talking to a guy who got all four division series wrong. All four. I had the A's playing the Yankees, and I had Arizona winning and playing Atlanta. I got them all wrong. I don't know if anyone else went 0-for-4. So, yes, I think this is exactly what this is about, is that the beauty of the game is that the four, you know, teams that were supposed to win, the four teams with home field advantage, didn't win. I'm still astonished that the Yankees not only lost, but the way that they lost. They looked old, they looked helpless, and it seemed to happen overnight. I mean, I thought this was Oakland's turn to beat the Yankees in the playoffs, and they didn't even get past the Twins. I thought with Schilling and Johnson pitching, you know, four times in five games, at least theoretically, that they would win that series. And I had Atlanta in five all along. So I can't be worse in the LCS predictions because there are only two of those. So maybe I'll go 0-2 in those.
All right. Your previous predictions notwithstanding, we got to give you your opportunity to do what we call you up to do. What's your prediction here on in?
Well, I think the Giants are going to win just because of their advantage, and they may do it quickly, meaning they may do it before they have to go back to St. Louis. So I'll take the Giants going to the World Series, and I'll take the Angels, and not because I don't love the Twins. Everybody loves the Twins, but the Angels are on a ride that I don't think a lot of teams have seen in a long time. So I'll take the Giants against the Angels in the World Series, and if I have to make a World Series pick, I'll take the Giants to win the World Series, and Barry Bonds finally gets the ring that he's wanted for so long.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and offers his opinions to Only a Game from time to time as well. Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Tim Kirkjian's prediction notwithstanding, Angels fans feel their team would play David to Dusty Baker's Goliath-like Giants or Tony La Russa's Cardinals should Anaheim advance to the World Series. But Anaheim must first win two of their next four games if the Angels are to sing the Twins to their rest. As Nick Roman of member station KKJZ in Long Beach reports, the Angels' long-suffering fans believe that will happen.
Dave Groot, a practical, thoughtful Orange County businessman, has been a faithful believer in the Angels for more than 20 years. Like Job's, Dave's faith has been tested, severely tested, often by play so inept that it sent him fleeing the ballpark.
And I remember those long walks to the car and listening to the game on the radio as more runs are coming across the plate and thinking, oh gosh, why? Why am I an Angel fan?
A belief in the existence of angels in the World Series requires faith, great faith, and few baseball fans have had their faith tested so often as Angel fans. Fans of the Cubs and the Red Sox are long-suffering, but at least they have World Series memories. The Angels' history of tribulations would have Job canceling his season tickets, freak injuries, sudden and total late-season collapses. 1986, one strike away from the World Series. Dave Groot tries to ignore the thought that his Angels have been cursed, but he can't.
I guess at this point, if I'm going to go along with this curse thing, I'm telling you, it hasn't been broken yet. As the time we sit here, they've not gotten into that World Series.
3 days ago at Edison International Field in Anaheim, the Angels began selling World Series tickets. An early morning congregation in the parking lot grew into the thousands. Margaret Kuyama was tucked into a line that stretched around the stadium.
I just want to be here, and this will be my first World Series game, and I'm just really looking forward to it. Too bad Mr. Autry isn't here to join in, you know, in the pleasure of having his team play and win.
The late Gene Autry, who founded the Angels and brought the team to Anaheim at the urging of Walt Disney himself, spent lavishly on players. His eternal reward was disappointment. The Walt Disney Company, which now owns the Angels and a lot of Anaheim, has pinched pennies on players while squeezing dollars from fans. For its sins of avarice, Disney might not pay pennants, but might be paid in pennants, the kind that fly from the center field flagpole at happier ball yards. This is a mystery, proof of a greater plan we cannot understand, one that requires faith. And that brings us back to the stadium parking lot. Joe Eikenberry arrived Wednesday just as the sun was rising, not to get tickets, but to get a wristband, Joe's sign of faith.
They're going to do the number for what the start number is for selling tickets. Instead of it first come, first serve, it's whatever number they draw by the lottery, and that determines where the start is.
So Joe might get tickets, and he might not, and the Angels might not make it to the series at all. Joe pondered that the day after the Angels fell to Twins pitcher Joe Mays, 4-8 during the season.
It was a good game last night. Guy pitched well for Minnesota. They'll come back. I still have faith.
It's hard to hold on to faith in the face of compelling evidence to the contrary. But Parker Abdo can do it. He's only 10, with no memories of 1986. He was only 3 when the 1995 Angels blew a 13.5 game lead to Seattle in less than a month. Parker's been an Angel fan for one whole year and hasn't heard a word of doubt.
Not really. They never really said they weren't good, and I never heard anybody say that.
Never at all.
Well, I might have, but not as I remember.
Faith clears away doubt.
I just have a feeling that Angels are going to come back and win. I can just feel it.
You can. You ever felt like that before?
Not really, but now it's just a feeling that I can just tell that the Angels are going to go on to the World Series.
From Parker's mouth to, well, soon enough, Angel fans will know if someone upstairs is listening. For Only a Game, I'm Nick Roman in Orange County, California.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Sometimes the right competitor wins. That must have been the sentiment throughout the knitting community when Lily Chin, author of The Urban Knitter, a book said to be aimed at the new generation of hip young knitters, won the National U.S. Speed Crochet Contest in New York on Sunday. "I think it is so thrilling," said Ms. Chin, who acknowledged that she expects her achievement to gain her mention in the Guinness Book of Records. In the contest itself, Lily Chin completed a dandy 92.5 double crochet stitches in 3 minutes, utterly crushing British crochet title holder Susan Brosco by a mind-boggling 16 stitches.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. A winning week on Wall Street, the first in more than a month, as the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped over 300 points. To read more, log on to WBUR.org and click on News. We are funded by you, our listeners, and by the Boston International Antiquarium Book Fair, featuring rare books, modern first editions, maps, and autographs. October 25th through 27th at the Heinz Convention Center, online at bostonbookfair.com. The Nature Conservancy, working with communities, businesses, and residents to save the last great places for future generations in Massachusetts. Information available at nature.org. And Nixon Peabody, LLP, providing legal services to local, national, and global businesses with offices in the East and in California. On the web at nixonpeabody.com. 57 degrees of light rain in Boston. The time is 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. But first, in many ways, Sandy Koufax, who won 25 or more games 3 times between 1963 and 1966, must seem very strange to baseball fans who've only come to a consciousness of the game over the past few decades. He pitched complete games, 54 of them in the last 2 seasons of his career. He retired at 30, more concerned with his health than his place in the record books or his bank account. He couldn't have been less interested in celebrity. These qualities, as much as his brilliance as a pitcher, made him an irresistible subject for biography, or so thought Jane Levy, who joins me now from the studios of NPR in Washington. Jane Levy, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot. It's nice to be here.
You acknowledge in the preface of the book that Sandy Koufax, quote, made it clear that he didn't want the book to be written. Why were you so determined to go ahead and write it?
I guess I like a challenge. I was intrigued by the guy for all the reasons that you just mentioned. It is so anomalous in this culture to say, you know, I've had my 15 minutes of fame and that's enough for me. And Sandy Koufax was someone who absolutely loved pitching. He was as fierce a competitor as you could have had. Catcher said his eyes burned with such intensity they thought it would burn through the back of his head. But he didn't need baseball to know who he was. He needed to leave baseball in order to find out who he was. And in order to lead a complete life, he wanted to have use, complete use of his left arm. He wanted to be able to button his own shirts, comb his own hair, brush his own teeth. And so at age 30, after having the best game of his career, one of the best games any pitcher's ever had, he walked away.
You mentioned the left arm, and of course, no story of Koufax can leave it out, both because he worked such magic with it and because he endured such pain in it. The descriptions in the book of what he went through are absolutely amazing.
Well, you know, medical technology in the mid-60s was still fairly primitive. Ice as an analgesic was a new concept. Koufax used a salve called Capsulin. Mm-hmm. It's no longer marketed in this country because it's so lethal. And it's made of red hot chili peppers. And I made some. I got a recipe out of a health food book and made some and slathered it on myself to find out. And it is the medical equivalent of hitting yourself on the head with, you know, against a brick wall.
Yeah,
it burns so much that you just forget any other pain could possibly exist.
You tell a story of one of his teammates who was cold in the bullpen one evening, and he took one of Koufax's old sweatshirts and put it on, and within a few minutes his eyes were tearing and he was sick to his stomach just from the residue of this stuff.
And it wasn't just him. The trainers made the mistake of donating one of those famous number 32 jerseys to a local Little League. And the poor kid who got 32 ran off the field screaming, "I'm on fire."
And Koufax went through this for years, as you say, because this at least distracted him from the pain in his arm.
Exactly right. And when it couldn't be handled by this salve, he took codeine. And he, in fact, was worried. One of the reasons he retired when he did was he was worried that his reaction time was so slowed by the codeine that if somebody had lined a ball up the middle through the, you know, past the pitcher's mound, he wouldn't have the wherewithal to duck in time.
You talked, of course, to numbers of players who had hit against Koufax, and you collected their comments. They were, I gather, nearly unanimous in their agreement that he was the most difficult pitcher that they'd ever faced. And I particularly liked a comment Yogi Berra made after facing Koufax in the World Series after the 63 season. Koufax had gone 25-5 that year, and Yogi asked, "How did he lose five? And I wonder how he did."
And Maury Wills replied, "He didn't. We lost them for him." You know, Yogi said something else that was really interesting. Apparently, he would have batted next after the late, lamentable Harry Bright. I don't mean that Harry's dead. He just struck out. Yogi would have been the next hitter. And I asked Yogi how he felt about that. And he said Yogi was leery. Now, I didn't know Yogi knew that word.
I love it. I love it. Beyond the talent, of course, and the achievements as a pitcher, Sandy Koufax was unusual because he was the relatively rare Jewish athlete who became a major league star. Hank Greenberg comes to mind, but not so very many others. And in some circles, he's better known as the man who chose not to pitch a World Series game on Yom Kippur than as a guy who threw four no-hitters. And yet, he was not an especially religious man, I gather.
No, and that's one of the things that really both surprised and impressed me. He's an inadvertent religious icon. He's not a religious man. He is not a devout Jew. And he was presumed to be by his teammates and by the Jewish community because he refused to pitch this game. And he never commented on it. He never explained his reasoning, which was, I thought, quite elegant and eloquent. I mean, there was nothing you could say that would improve upon what he did. But the fact of the matter was, he spent that day alone in his hotel room. He did not go to synagogue, and nor was he bar mitzvahed, for that matter. That's not to say he isn't a very Jewish being, as his friend Fred Wilpon, owner of the Mets, said of him. He's got a very Jewish New York sensibility. It's in his Brooklyn shrug. It's in his sense of humor. It's in the fact that he can spell forget about it. But but he's not a practicing Jew. And I think he is actually quite embarrassed and incredulous at the degree of reverence that has been accorded him for this act, which was, on his part, reflexive.
One of Sandy Koufax's fellow Dodgers, one of his teammates, Wes Parker, said of him that Koufax sacrificed some of his humanity to attain perfection. This was a phrase that Parker had gotten out of Life magazine, I guess, applied to somebody else altogether. But I wonder if Sandy Koufax would agree with that assessment, though.
Well, he's said to friends, and who repeated it to me, maybe I was a little tired of being me. He demanded so much of himself as a performer. He held himself to such standards and felt such an enormous responsibility to his teammates that it had to be exhausting. He prepared for his starts in a way that, frankly, I don't think anybody else ever had before. I mean, he would drag his roommate, Dick Trzewski, out of bed and say, I want to throw in the middle of the night. And poor Dick Trzewski, living on the other side of L.A., would get up and drive across town because Sandy Koufax wanted to throw the ball.
You mentioned earlier the way many athletes need to play in order to be complete. That's a phrase from the book. And you said Koufax didn't seem to need to keep playing to be complete. In fact, he had to quit the game to become Sandy Koufax and take up his life. Do you have the sense now that he's a happy guy?
He is one of the least needy human beings I have ever met in my life. He has a sense of who he is that is not predicated on us telling him and reminding him. I am not surprised when people ask me all the time, has he read the book? The answer is no. Nor did he read the Sports Illustrated cover story that proclaimed him the athlete of the century, the incomparable and mysterious Sandy Koufax. He doesn't want to live in the past, certainly not in his own past. And I think that he loved baseball far more than people ever realized. He loved to compete. I think it was painful for him to quit. I think it was hard for him to walk away and say, I'm putting down the ball, and this thing that I do better than I do anything else, better than perhaps anybody else has ever done it, I can't do anymore because it's destructive to me. And, you know, people talk about him as a recluse. A recluse is a guy who avoids people. Sandy Koufax only avoids celebrity. And I think in this country, in this culture, we've forgotten that there's a difference between those two things.
Obviously, Sandy Koufax was a fascinating individual to you before you took on this assignment. Did you have as much fun as you thought you would writing this book?
Well, considering I grew up a Yankee fan and hating him, I had a lot more fun. And one of the things that I think was really terrific and unanticipated, I spoke to 469 people, and the unanimity about Koufax was absolutely startling. As a reporter, that's the last thing you expect. And the word used most often to describe him is gentle. This is not a word that rolls off ballplayers' tongues. And, you know, it's almost a challenge to a reporter. Oh, yeah, you're going to tell me he's that nice? Let me go find somebody who says something opposite. So I kept looking and looking, and more people said nicer and nicer things about him. And at the end of the process, I went back to him and I said, you know, I talked to 469 people. And if 469 people had said you were a lousy guy, I would have written that you were a lousy guy because that's my job. And he, with his wry Brooklyn Jewish New York sensibility, said to me, 469 people can't be wrong.
Jane Levy is the author of Sandy Koufax, A Lefty's Legacy, published by HarperCollins. Jane, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
The ice is hard, the blades are bent for the 2002-2003 NHL season. Here to help us herald in the current hockey campaign is Helene Elliott, Isis of Ice Resurfacing for the LA Times and Only a Game's Belle of the Blue Line. Welcome back to Only a Game, Helene.
Why, thank you. You know, it is so tough to defend those titles. I think it's tougher to defend than it is to win it the first time. So.
That's always that way. It's
mm-hmm,
true.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Wings, this year's Stanley Cup winners, prepared to repeat by signing a veteran goalie to replace the recently retired Dominik Hasek. Curtis Joseph has never seen his name on a cup, so is Detroit's choice a good one?
You know, I've never really been a big fan of his, but you look at the defense and you've got to say that this guy has a chance to actually win something this time around. The defense in front of him is just so smart. They limit the shots against that even Cujo has a chance to be a winner this time.
The 2001 champion Colorado Avalanche recently traded Chris Drury, a player with a knack of producing clutch playoff goals. I guess the team that doesn't plan to make the playoffs this year doesn't need him, or what?
Well, you know, Colorado has a history of trading for these big puck-moving defensemen, and this kid that they got, Derek Morris, is by all accounts a really big star of the future. He's going to be able to help their power play. He's going to be able to give guys like Rob Blake a rest. I mean, they were playing Rob Blake so many minutes. I mean, I think the guy was just going to disappear. He lost so much weight. But now that they have a little bit more depth on the blue line, I think they're going to be a Stanley Cup finalist.
What other teams do we look for coming out of the West besides Detroit and Colorado?
I think it'll be interesting to see how Dallas retools this season. They actually went out. They made some moves. They signed Bill Guerin as a free agent, and Guerin is one of these power forwards that coaches and general managers love so much. I think that it was kind of a bad year for them last season. They're a team that doesn't like to miss the playoffs. They're a team that has a pretty good amount of pride. They're not going to settle for something, and I'm looking for them to rebound in a big way this season.
The Carolina Hurricanes provided what might have been the NHL's story of the season. Then they came up short in the finals against the Red Wings. But was that spectacular run a fluke, or do we see Carolina playing for the Cup again in the spring?
What I want to know is whether 5 years from now we'll still see a team in Carolina and whether we'll still see fans coming to games in Carolina. I mean, we've seen this happen before in Florida where the Panthers made it to the finals 1 year and hockey was the big fad there and it was a big deal there. And then the team started to go downhill and the fans deserted. And I think that teams like Carolina and Florida and Tampa Bay that are in, you know, these non-traditional hockey markets, they have to do a better job of ensuring that they have roots in those cities.
I want to talk a little about the Boston Bruins. Despite having the Eastern Conference's best record last season, they just appear to be a player or two short during the playoffs. Is that still the case looking at this regular season?
Well, now you could argue that they're two more players short than what they were last season because they did not re-sign Byron Defoe, their goaltender, and defenseman Kyle MacLaren is holding out. So I think the Bruins are going to have some big problems this season, and I know that saddens you greatly. But I think that they're looking ahead to the new collective bargaining agreement. I think that the Bruins, who are always been very penny-pinching, they don't want to sign anybody long-term past September of 2004, which is when the current labor agreement ends. And they're hoping that there's going to be salary caps and all kinds of cost controls coming in. So they don't want to be stuck with any kind of contracts now. And no player is going to want to sign there if he can't get more than a year contract.
So which Eastern Conference team or teams do we see stepping up?
Well, as much as I hate to say it, I think the Flyers are a very attractive-looking team right now. I like Ken Hitchcock. He says he's going to play a more offense-oriented style with these new rules that crack down on obstruction. Of course, in Dallas, when he coached there, Hitchcock was known for these deadly, dull defensive games that just put people to sleep. But he does have some scoring talent up there, and they've got some size, they've got some speed. I'm curious to see how he does up there.
There will be some league-wide changes this year, the most notable, I suppose, being the National Hockey League's use of protective netting in the arenas behind the goals, quite obviously a response to the tragic death of 13-year-old Brittany Cecil at the Blue Jackets rink last March. Will the netting do what it's designed to do?
You know, I've heard so many complaints from fans about it, But Commissioner Bettman was in town the other day when we were talking about it, and he said, and I think he made a good point, is that he said, if you go into the rink and you're just fixated on it and you do nothing but stare at the net, it's going to bother you. He said, but if you just sit down and say, all right, I'm going to watch the game, it won't bother you. You'll watch the game. You'll just get used to it. I mean, there have been so many changes over the years that people have had to get used to. I'm sure this will just kind of, fade into the background. You know, there's no way to protect anybody 100%. You know, when you walk into a hockey game, you walk into a baseball stadium, you know that there's going to be some risks. Anytime you go to Fenway, you could get hit by a foul ball. So there's no way to protect everybody all of the time. But if there are situations where you can minimize the risks, why not?
Finally, Helene, on Sunday, Queen Elizabeth II dropped the ceremonial puck before the preseason game between Vancouver and San Jose. Of that drop, Hall of Fame hockey broadcaster Howie Meeker said, quote, I've seen a lot worse in the National Hockey League. Maybe the old girl should hold a clinic for NHL refs. What do you think?
I could see her standing there going, this is obstruction, and we are not amused by holding and hooking. Yeah, that could work.
Helene Elliott is penalty box pundit for the L.A. Times and our much-admired queen of mucking it up in the corners here at Only a Game. Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
We're going to play hockey. Boom, 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 boom. And we just might win. Boom, 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 boom. We will smear the opponent. Again, it's another night of hockey. We like to swing and play, and when we make goals, we say, hooray!
Hooray!
We have fun all night, but we never fight, even if our team lost. And we like new people on our team, but we try not to be mean.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Dover Rug Company, classic, contemporary, eclectic rugs and carpeting for today's lifestyle. Dover Rug Company, Natick and Hanover, on the web at DoverRug.com or 800-DOVER-RUG. Energy Star Homes, funded by local gas and electric companies, consulting with builders and buyers of new homes to meet the EPA's high energy performance standards. EnergyStarHomes.com. And A Street Frames, 21 years of framemaking for galleries, artists, and the public, offering museum-quality framing and professional advice in Cambridge near Fresh Pond and in Boston's South End. AStreetFrames.com. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Boston Bruins open their season with a loss. The Minnesota Wild beat the Bees 5-1 last night. The New England Revolution play their biggest game ever this afternoon when they host the Columbus Crew in Game 3 of their Major League Soccer semifinal playoff series. A win or a tie, and the Revs advance to the championship game at Gillette Stadium. This spring, travel to Vietnam and Cambodia and our next Citizens of the World tour. To learn more about this trip, call 800-909-9287. Rain today, windy, highs in the upper 50s. Tonight, rain likely, windy, overnight lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, a chance of rain, highs in the lower 60s. Monday, Columbus Day, sunny and breezy, highs in the 50s.
Monday, tune in at noon to WBUR's News Magazine, Here and Now. We'll have all the news, plus a look at two of the tightest political races in the country as midterm elections draw near. Also, Nancy Griffith has gone back to Rounder Records and come out with a new CD. We'll give it a listen. That's Here and Now, Monday at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, if I had a hammer, I'd throw it. But not as well as an 81-year-old guy from Maine does that. But first, the week's sports news with analyst Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Baseball's playoff landscape has become pretty intriguing, hasn't it? I hope that last spring you got a bet down on the Angels or the Twins making it to the World Series.
Well, almost nobody got a bet down on the Twins. I mean, how do you bet on a team that might not be there? The nice thing about it is that I was sitting around in my car on the way to do this today, and I realized that I probably couldn't name two pitchers on any team left in the playoffs.
Because all the teams with pitching aren't in the playoffs
and
anymore.
And I believe that this is the first time in baseball history that all four remaining teams are west of the Mississippi. The Twins are barely west of the Mississippi.
It's close. One of the many managerial openings created by all the postseason firings was filled this week when Detroit hired former Tiger shortstop Alan Trammell, and he said of Detroit, quote, "This is where my heart is." Will the Motor City be where the winds are as well as a result of that commitment?
Of course it's where his heart is. It's where his heart was stolen 10 years ago and left by the side of the road somewhere. You know, it's a good thing. He's a Tiger icon. He's a terrific guy. He will sell tickets for the first couple months of the season. The team will still stink, however. And there's almost nothing he can do about that.
Noted sports expert Andy Rooney of 60 Minutes fame announced on the Boomer Esiason show this past week, quote, "I am not a sexist person, but a woman has no business being down there on the sideline trying to make some comment about a football game." I don't quite know why anybody should care what Andy Rooney thinks, but apparently he's caused quite a flap.
Yeah, I mean, the existence of sideline reporters of either gender is their function has always been a little elusive to me. I'm not exactly sure what they do except get either ignored or lied to. I think there's a very high NASCAR factor on sideline reporters because I think people tune in just to see if, you know, a coach will either flirt with the women or take a swing at one of the guys or vice versa. Who knows? But doesn't anyone but me think it's a little bit ironic that Andy Rooney was talking about women not being qualified to talk about football on something called the Boomer Esiason show?
I want to know how many people watch the Boomer Esiason show. Indiana University President Miles Brand will become the NCAA's president and chief executive as of January 1st. What attributes do you suppose led the NCAA to make him its unanimous choice?
He fired Bob Knight and stood the gaff in Indiana, I'm fairly sure. Plus, they don't have to pay very much to move him because his house, he's probably still living around there. So it's interesting. He calls the Knight situation a, quote, learning experience. I'll bet it was. But he is making all the right noises about scaling back what he calls the basketball and football arms race that he said has become, quote, a threat to the academic integrity of the universities. Unfortunately, of course, if he does that, he doesn't get paid, and neither do any of the people in his office.
So it'll be a short tenure.
Absolutely.
If he manages to do that. The New England Revolution will play the Columbus Crew in Game 3 of the MLS Eastern Conference semifinals this afternoon. And if the Revs win or even draw, they'll play the LA Galaxy for the championship. I'm sure that matchup will equal the great Celtics-Lakers rivalries of the past, don't you think?
Well, I have already taken a graphite lock and locked my lawn chair onto a piece of curb on Commonwealth Ave in Boston for the ensuing New England Revolution victory parade.
We
joke
about
this.
Because
I do not want... No, you don't joke about this. I joke about this. The Galaxy tends to get there and lose, right? So that knocks your Celtics-Lakers analogy out of the box.
You're right. But how do you like Foxborough, Massachusetts as the home of two champions?
In the same stadium, a brand new stadium I guess Patriots are technically the world champions of American football. It'd be a pretty far stretch to say whoever wins the MLS is the world champion of soccer. I believe there's another competition where they play for that.
Whoever ends up owning the next NBA team to play in Charlotte, North Carolina, will not have a free hand with the team that he or she owns or they own or whatever it is. The details of the new team's arrangement with the city have already been worked out between the league and various Charlotte banks. I wonder if the owner will get to sit in the owner's box even.
I think that's probably one of the perks, actually, that you do get to pretend to be the owner if you're not exactly. This is, of course, an attempt to smooth over things between the National Basketball Association, the fans of Charlotte, and whatever team comes in there, and the business community, since the relationship between the previous owners, last seen sailing a small sloop down the Spanish Main on the way to New Orleans, had fallen apart to the point where nobody was speaking to anybody. So this, I believe, is largely a tripartite peace plan worked out by David Stern. Russ Granick, who's an NBA official, said it's like building a house on spec that's 90% done, but you can still choose the tile in the bathroom. Thank you, Russ.
That's a great metaphor. This week, Chinese authorities kicked center Wang Zhuzhu off the national team for playing an exhibition game with the L.A. Clippers rather than going home to play in an Asian tournament for China. Zhuzhu will apparently have to, quote, admit his wrongdoing to get back on the Chinese team. And I think there's a clause in every NBA contract that says under no circumstance will a player admit any wrongdoing. So he's cooked.
The motherland needed him, and he didn't care what was good for the country and was unwilling to serve the country, says the Chinese media service. Much more willing to serve the Los Angeles Clippers was Wang Zhiji. Actually, the Chinese news service sounds like a lot of American sports columnists talking about the Ryder Cup. It's very bizarre.
The National Hockey League announced this week, Charlie, that it would begin selling game-worn jerseys this year. 21 of the league's 30 teams will participate in the plan, but the jerseys will apparently be cleaned before they're sold. So how are you supposed to know if they're really game-worn?
Game-worn, but not gamey. NHL jerseys. May I be the first to say, about this particular plan? I mean, wouldn't they be worth more if there was still, like, real NHL sweat on them?
Yeah, and blood.
Blood. Very good.
Would be good. Okay.
Excellent.
Finally, Charlie, the pride of Switzerland has been restored. The world record for largest simultaneous yodel has been returned to that country by 937 energetic yodelers. And weird as it may seem, the previous record had been set in Ireland.
Accidentally in a pub one night, I would guess. But it was interesting because they set two records that night. The Swiss set the record for mass yodeling and also the record for most people simultaneously putting their hands over their ears and going, "Stop it, please!"
Charlie Pierce, the Irish champion yodeler of, I think it was 1976, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and comments on Sports for Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Maybe Minnesota will get by Anaheim. Maybe the Twins will win the World Series. But even if they don't, they'll have provided the story baseball commissioner Bud Selig must have most dreaded when this season began. For Selig, his protestations notwithstanding, even a work stoppage might have been preferable to a triumphant season for one of the two teams he'd tried to eliminate via contraction of the major leagues. An interrupted season would have made at least some of Mr. Selig's employers happy, since it would have provided the game's most militant owners with an opportunity to restructure baseball to their own greater benefit while the stadium gates were locked. But this is a disaster for a man determined to prove that only wealthy teams like the Yankees, Braves, Dodgers, and Red Sox can succeed, while relatively small market clubs are doomed to disappoint their fans and drag the business of baseball into insolvency. It's no surprise that the success of the Twins has provoked all manner of nose-thumbing from Minnesota fans, as well as from others who regard pretty much everything the commissioner says as self-serving rubbish. One South Dakota gentleman who calls himself Wally Firesteel, the cowboy and baseball poet, sent Only a Game a Casey-at-the-bat-type epic that presents fans snarling and Commissioner Bud eating crow in the owner's box as the Twins win again. It ends, "And all throughout this northern land, the sun is shining bright, and bands are playing everywhere. 5 million hearts are light, and people still are laughing, and little children shout. There's joy in the Twin Cities. Silly Selig has struck out." Only a postseason appearance by the Montreal Expos, the other team Mr. Selig considered expendable, could have made the commissioner feel sillier. Of course, despite the Casey-like strikeout, Silly Seelig will no doubt be back at the proverbial plate at some point to maintain again that baseball's going broke. The success of the Twins, even if it's rings all around in Minnesota for the third time since 1987, will be no more than a reprieve. Happy, but evanescent as a snow day from the overheated drone of doom. All this is not to suggest that those who love the game and dislike self-righteous manipulative posturing shouldn't relish the sweet, unlikely success the Twins have snatched from their fall this autumn. In fact, maybe Minnesota's bright ride is all the more delightful if we recognize that the commissioner will inevitably strike up his dirge again, and that the Yankees and the Braves, like the rich, will always be with us. Some people spend their retirement years taking it easy, but not Bob Chase of Shapley, Maine. Mr. Chase is a world-class track and field athlete who swings with the best, despite his relatively advanced years. Maine Public Radio's Matthew Algio has this profile.
It's a blazing hot summer day, and 81-year-old Bob Chase is doing what he does just about every day. He's standing in a gravel pit just outside Shapley, Maine, perfecting his hammer-throwing technique.
Now watch out.
Chase isn't really throwing a hammer. He's actually throwing a 9-pound iron ball attached to a 4-foot-long metal wire with a handle at the end. Chase grabs the handle and slowly spins the ball around his head a few times. Then he spins his whole body around, faster and faster, to generate maximum momentum. He lets go of the rod, and the ball sails high into the air, landing on the sand with a satisfying thud. Chase can throw the hammer nearly 100 feet. In fact, he holds the U.S. record for the 80 to 84-year-old age division. Chase began his hammer-throwing career nearly 70 years ago when he was a teenager in Kennebunk, Maine. One day, he happened to see the local high school track coach throwing the hammer.
I watched him throw and was enamored with it, and asked him if he could show me how to do it. He said, sure, and he taught me, and I loved it.
It turned out that Chase was pretty good at the hammer throw, a track and field event that traces its roots to the ancient Celts, who threw real hammers as a test of strength, still observed in Scotland. Chase excelled at the hammer throw in high school and continued to compete in the event when he went to Harvard.
And my last throw was in May of 1942 in New Haven, Connecticut at the Yale meet.
How did you do?
I won it.
After college, Chase served 2 years in the Army during the Second World War. He returned home, started a family, he has 7 children, and enjoyed a long, successful career in the frozen seafood industry.
I never did pick up the hammer again until 2000, the year 2000. That's when I started again.
Chase was retired and looking for something to do to keep himself active, so he did a little test to see if he could still throw the hammer after a 58-year break.
I got 2 empty-gallon milk jugs, filled them with water, tied a 4-foot hunk of rope on it to the handles, and I wanted to find out if I could swing it around my head and not fall down.
Not only could he swing it around his head without falling down, he could throw it pretty far, too. So he bought a proper hammer and began practicing, first at the local landfill, then at the gravel pit. Then Chase learned about the Masters Championships, a track and field meet for older competitors. He called one of the organizers of the event.
And he asked me what I was doing, and I told him it was around 85, 90 feet. He said, "My God, man, you're in the top 10 in the world." And I said, "Oh, come on." He said, "Oh, yeah, certainly in the top 10 and probably the top 5.
At the Masters Championships in Baton Rouge last summer, Chase not only beat a handful of competitors to finish first, he set the U.S. record for his age division in the hammer throw, 99 feet 8 inches. But that is still a far cry from the overall world record. Olympic-caliber athletes can throw the hammer more than 200 feet, a fact that Chase can barely grasp.
I mean, I can't believe that. I believe it because I have to, but it's fantastic, fantastic, and beautiful to watch. They're beautiful to watch when they're turning for me. It's just a poetry in motion. It's beautiful.
Chase says he can't throw the hammer as far as he did at Harvard, But at 5'11", 175, he still has the build of a college athlete and a fiery competitive spirit.
I just want to throw, and I want to push that record up. It's that simple.
Chase is passionate about the hammer throw, and while we were out at the gravel pit, he insisted on giving me a quick lesson.
Now, you swing it around your head as many or as few times as you want.
So like this, basically?
Yeah, that's generally it. Then you turn.
Then just turn and release?
Turn and release.
Okay.
I spin the big metal ball around a few times and unleash it.
Well, that's, what, 40 feet? So you're warming up now.
I'd thrown it less than half as far as Chase usually does, which seems somewhat appropriate, since I'm less than half his age. For Only a Game, I'm Matthew Algio in Shapley, Maine.
You can say what you like, you're alone. Knock down the wall, swallow the phone. You're all alone, it won't change. He says what he wants, he stands up. She says what she thinks, she gives up. Her time's up, it won't change.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Andy Farnsworth, John Hoder, and from Kimberly Jones at NPR in Washington. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter or learn more about Sandy Koufax, a lefty's legacy, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Koufax biographer Jane Levy, who shares with us the left-hander's attitude toward his own enduring fame.
I've heard him say, you know, the older I get, the better I used to be.
Whoa, one last curve from that purveyor of profound parabolas. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR.
Radio.
This is WBUR.